Now, back to Whitley on Wine.
Slowly.
With your host, nationally syndicated wine columnist, Robert Whitley.
Okay, we're back, and I'm chatting with James Hall, the winemaker at Patson Hall Winery. And coming up in the final segment, I will visit with Jesse Rodriguez, who's the wine director and sommelier at the Addison Restaurant at the Grand Del Mar. And Jesse, prior to the Addison, was at the French Laundry, ran the wine program there. And especially heading into the holidays now, that should be a very interesting conversation. Anyway, getting back to James Hall and Patson Hall, James, Pinot Noir at one time in California, as you said earlier in the program, really didn't get a lot of respect. Your grape sources didn't exist. Oregon got way out in front of you.
Oh, yeah.
What happened? What turned that all around?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with availability of better Pinot Noir grape material. In the early days, UC Davis was very concerned about increasing the yields out of California selections of fruit because the old grape material was infected with viruses. And so they were very concerned about eliminating the viruses and increasing yield.
Mm-hmm.
Well, increasing yield is not the way to go with Pinot Noir. You end up with light wines with no acid and very little flavor and character. And so they were, you know, that works okay for some other varieties like Cabernet and Zinfandel, but it was the wrong approach for Pinot. And the real turning point was in the early 80s when the University of Oregon got access to these selections of Pinot Noir from Burgundy called the Dijon selections,
mm-hmm.
which were isolated at the University of Dijon in northern Burgundy. Those were selected for very small berries and high color and high aromatic expression. And once we started to plant those cuttings here in the North Coast, it was a transformation. Suddenly the vineyards had way more color and character and acid and aromas, and boy, the wines really took a step up. And as soon as people started tasting these, it was like, holy cow, we can grow Pinot Noir in Sonoma. And
mm-hmm.
It was like a light bulb went off. Everyone and their uncle went, you know, into the Pinot business, it seemed like. So it was a little bit of a land rush, really.
And then, of course, there was the movie Sideways, which created a stampede. You know, that just kind of boggles the mind, but it, in fact, that's what happened.
Ironically, that movie was really about Merlot. And when they finally made it, it became all about Pinot Noir. But it's an interesting movie for sure. It helped the wine business, yeah. No kidding.
Well, you know, I don't think I'm going out on a limb here. I think three of the best Pinots that I've tasted this year were Pinots that that you made. One was from Chenoweth Vineyard, which I believe is Sonoma Coast.
That is in Russian River.
Is that Russian River?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
Then also the Hyde, which is in Carneros,
yes.
And the Pasoni, which is down in Monterey County, Santa Lucia Highlands. And all three of those are very different.
Well,
now, what I think would be interesting to listeners mm-hmm. is to hear you describe the different vineyards and why they give you what they give you and, mm-hmm. and how the wines actually differ.
Well, that's really one of the basic ideas behind our winery, is that the vineyards need to have a personality and a character that stands alone, so that when you taste them side by side, you get a real sense of the place the wines come from. Hyde Vineyards is one of my favorites. It was planted in the early 80s by Larry Hyde, who is an autodidact viticulturist who has a deep passion for wine, had some connections with Romani Conti, traveled in Burgundy widely, in fact met his wife in Burgundy, and got into the wine business planting his vineyards because he had a deep passion for wine. And the vineyard is very cold. It tends to get a lot of very cold air off of the Golden Gate, and it's planted to a very diverse selection of Pinot Noir cuttings. Larry has taken cuttings from other vineyards and developed them. And so it's the most diverse mixture of Pinot Noir cuttings we have. But Hyde is always noted for this sort of cherry, kirsch, spicy, high-frequency red fruit quality, and very soft, plush tannins. The soils are very shallow, and it just makes these very lush, friendly, easy-to-enjoy wines. Chenoweth Vineyards is an interesting story. The Chenoweth family moved into Sonoma in the 1830s, and at one point had tens of thousands of acres of western Sonoma. And in the days before land regulation, they were able to carve up their estate, and they eventually ended up with 600 acres. They had an apple orchard on this property, almost an 8-acre apple orchard. And Charlie Chenoweth, the youngest of the Chenoweth clan, was a grape grower. He had a farming company, and he did contract labor. Well, he went to his father and convinced him that apples were really a terrible business, and convinced him to pull this 100-year-old apple orchard out, which was no small feat. I mean, mm-hmm. His dad did not want to give up granddad's apple orchard. And Charlie planted on this beautiful little south-facing knoll a fabulous Pinot vineyard. The soils are very deep and well-drained, lots of sand. And so they're very low vigor. Sand doesn't have a lot of nutrition in it. So the vines are very small. And Russian River wines tend to have a very complex sort of raspberry, cherry note, but also a lot of tannin and structure and acid in particular. Mm-hmm. And so Chenoweth just seemed to be this quintessential Russian River site. The first few years...
A lot of depth.
Beautiful depth. Mm-hmm. And just precocious... I fell in love with it the first time I smelled it, and I really wanted to make a single vineyard, but we had to hold off for a couple of years and let the vineyard develop a bit. And so finally, with the 04 vintage, we had mature enough vines, and it was just drop-dead gorgeous. It was love at first sight. The Chenoweths are a great family, and Charlie, being a professional grape grower, really puts his heart and soul into this, since it's kind of his flagship vineyard, and it's a way to show other vineyard owners and prospective clients what he's capable of doing. So he is an extraordinary guy. Pozzoni Vineyards, probably the most famous of the three, is an area in Santa Lucia Highlands near the town of Gonzales in the Salinas Valley. And the Salinas Valley is very cold. It is a valley that runs towards Monterey Bay. And the Monterey Bay, it has very cold ocean water. And so the fog tends to run up the Salinas Valley, and that's one reason it's such a great place to grow lettuce. Mm-hmm. Well, the Pozzoni Vineyards is on a hillside facing the south, so it gets nice sun, southeast actually, so it gets morning and quite warm sun. And it's just above the fog line. So if it's a very, very heavy fog day, the fog will get into the vineyards. But typically the fog is just at the base of the vineyard, mm-hmm. so it gives the cooling effect without actually covering the vines in the fog. And that seems to produce a much brighter fruit character, but also just a depth of flavor that I have not seen at any other site. It's an extraordinary vineyard. He sells grapes to almost 12 wineries now. Mm-hmm. And every single wine from Pozzoni Vineyards, no matter who makes it, has this Pozzoni character that just shines through that is really hard to mistake. And in my opinion, that's the mark of a true vineyard. If it can be treated by different winemakers with different fermentation techniques and barrels and yeast and all of that, and through all of those differences, this unique vineyard character shows, that's a sign of greatness.
And of the three, it seems to me that's probably the ripest fruit you get.
Yes.
Yeah, and that seems to me, from the other Pozzoni Pinots that I've tasted, to be a characteristic of the vineyard.
Yes, it is relatively cool with all that fog, and so it takes a long time to get the tannins ripe. And if you pick it too early, it's really a tannic beast. It requires a lot of time on the vines to age mm-hmm. those tannins, and so the sugars are a bit higher than our other vineyards. Chenoweth is the lowest alcohol, Pozzoni's the highest. And so the Pozzoni, though, it keeps its Pinot character despite being the largest structured of the three. Often when Pinot Noirs get into that sort of uber-ripe, over-the-top style, they become sort of generic, red wine, maybe even...
More like Syrah.
Syrah, or even like a Zinfandel sometimes. Mm-hmm. But Pozzoni is always Pinot, and... That's one of the things I love about it.
Now, what about the sister vineyard down there, Gary's?
Well, it's a partnership between Gary Pozzoni and Gary Francione, and it's a much cooler vineyard.
Now,
it's
closer to the water. Do you make Gary's?
No, we don't. They offered us some fruit, and it was a very tempting proposition. And
they wanted too much money.
Well, you know, that wasn't really the issue. It was more a question of being close enough to be involved in the vineyard.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, several Russian River vineyards like Chenoweth were, you know, becoming available to us. And we mm-hmm. thought, you know, we just don't want to spread ourselves too thin and get too many vineyards that are far away from the winery and, you know, drop the ball during harvest. And so it was really just a logistical question, and I'm kicking myself, I can tell you.
Okay,
you
know,
awesome,
I'm going to ask you one final question, James, before we get out of here. We're going to have to take a break, but in your opinion, what is the best region for Pinot Noir in California?
I think Sonoma Coast and Russian River.
Sonoma Coast and Russian River.
And, you know, of course, that's the one I'm most familiar with, too. So.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and you make great wines from both areas. Anyway, it's been a delight to have you.
Oh, thank you so much, Robert.
And good luck with the vintage that you're working on right now. I know all the wines in the cellar.
The 07s are unbelievable. So, it is the best Pinot Noir vintage I've ever seen.
That gives us something to look forward to. Anyway, coming back after the break, mm-hmm. we will visit with Jesse Rodriguez, the sommelier at Addison at the Grand Del Mar.
Peel me a grape.
And now, back to Whitley on Wine.
Slowly.
With your host, nationally syndicated wine columnist, Robert Whitley.
Welcome back. And now we're moving on to our next guest. Jesse Rodriguez, the wine director and sommelier at Addison at the Grand Del Mar, and he has been winning much acclaim recently for the wine selection in the cellar. Welcome, Jesse.
Thank you.
21,000 bottles, I hear.
And growing.
Growing. And how many wines did you have at the French Laundry?
The French Laundry's list, when I left, we were roughly at around 1,800 selections.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because we talk about it, and you know, when myself and some of the other sommeliers that work there, and also I still keep in touch that used to work at Per Se,
mm-hmm.
and we used to joke and say how it's fantasy land. You know, you can build up a vertical of, like, say, Marcus and Estate Pinot Noir,
mm-hmm.
and within a month, you only have 3 selections left.
So you have to stay on top of it all the time.
Yeah, the French Laundry really taught me how to be very, very good with watching inventory, as a lot of wine directors I've met out here do. I mean, they're great mm-hmm. people, but more so there than any other place because, you know, you have so much high-end wine that just turns instantly that yeah. you have to watch, like, okay, wow, that vertical's no longer in existence. I have to buy another one. Who do I go to source these wines out from?
Well, you know, that's one of the reasons I wanted to chat with you today. I was looking at the size of that list, and you've won the Wine Spectator Grand Award. You've done extremely well. And the restaurant isn't that old. How do you source that level of wine, that amount of wine, and get these older vintages that nobody else can find?
It was really building a network with a lot of the people in the Bay Area. That we used at French Laundry.
Mm-hmm.
So don't want to really mention their names, but they're really great gray market suppliers.
Uh-huh.
And so they helped us out immensely at French Laundry and at Per Se.
So tell me what the gray market is. I kind of have an idea, but...
Yeah. Well, essentially, gray market is they sell you products. I'll give you a classic example of a great gray market producer. It'd be the Rare Wine Company based out in Sonoma. Mm-hmm. So they sell you product that's, you know, vintage stuff that's no longer available,
mm-hmm.
and they'll have a vertical of it, and they'll go, okay, here you go. We have a vertical of Finca Dofi. We have a vertical of La Ermita. These are the prices. And usually, you know, when you buy from regular distributors, they have the current vintage, and then mm-hmm. after that, they look to deplete their inventory.
Sure.
This
yeah.
right here,
it's all about turnover with them.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's all about, here's what we currently have. There you go. This, the gray market, they really kind of redefine that in that they say, you know, our specialty, our forte is going to be small boutique artisanal champagne and verticals of it,
mm-hmm.
Or, you know, high-end German Riesling and, you know, back vintages of it as well. So you can just kind of go through and go, if I need to find vintage German Riesling, I need to contact De Terrio from Divine Wines over in San Francisco. Okay, great. So in doing that at French Laundry, it really kind of helped me out going, okay, these are my go-to people when I need stuff to fill up, vintage vintage product. So they've been great.
Do you ever buy up someone's cellar, like an estate sale or something like that, or is that too much of an investment in inventory? Do you prefer to just kind of go to somebody who is sort of brokering this sort of thing?
You know, I haven't purchased anyone, so I've been approached numerous times. Mm-hmm. Would I be interested in that? It's tough because you don't know, first and foremost, A, how long they've had those wines, B, what kind of condition have they been stored in, C, these gray market people that we do business with here at the Grand Del Mar, mm-hmm. I know them so well that they, if a bottle's off or it's corked, we don't eat that difference. They go ahead and go, no problem, give me that, and I'll give you a credit for that amount.
Okay. That's a good way to do business, I believe.
Absolutely, because, you might, eat $500 one month, but the next month, we're buying, say, $2,000 worth of product from them. Yeah. So, it makes sense.
Well, I used to buy from a wine shop. I won't mention the name. It's not under the same ownership and hasn't been for some time. And especially around the holidays, I would get great deals because I would go into the shop every once in a while. And I'd browse around. I'd look at the Bordeaux and I'd look at the Burgundy and I'd kind of, grouse about the prices to the owner of the shop. And we would get close to the holidays and he would buy champagne on what he called the gray market, and I guess he bought it out of London, but he had to have cash to do that. And so I would usually get a phone call, and he would say, "Robert, you've been looking at that Chateau Margaux. How much would you buy if I gave it to you for such and such a price?" Now then, I would say, "Okay, I'll take a case, or I'll take two cases," but then I had to give him cash because that's what he needed to buy his wine on the gray market.
Right.
It's funny how these things evolve.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting, actually, because I never knew what the gray market was. I never knew how that all operated. I used to work for a distributor in Arizona, and so I just figured, if you need stuff, you just go to the distributor, and they should have all that stuff, or you contact the winery directly. And in a way, that can help out, but mm-hmm. it's really good when you have a relationship with those gray market people, because they can just really, if you put it out there, like, I'm looking for product X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. Can you guys help me out? They do all the research for you.
Yeah. I see from your bio that you were on the sales side at one time. What led you to the desire to become a sommelier?
It all started when I was going to grad school. I was going to school at Arizona State,
mm-hmm.
and I just remember seeing the sommeliers at the Phoenician Resort. They just looked so sharp, in their tuxedos and and that bling around that neck.
Right.
I just thought, wow, that looks incredible. I want to look something like that.
Looks cool, yeah.
It looks really cool. And, I was studying history and education, and, for me, this was just another way for me to kind of go into another part of the restaurant industry.
Mm-hmm.
And something that was interesting because it really kind of applied everything that I was studying on a history aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Together, like, that makes sense, what's going on here and what they used to do, and, now I can bring in wine and have something fun to study about in addition to that.
Well, how did you educate your palate about wines from all over the world?
You know what, for me, it was working with some incredible master sommeliers and just incredible sommeliers in general, and for them, just keeping quiet and asking the right questions of going, how do you detect that? How do you know that? In Germany, this is what German Riesling tastes like in the Mosel,
mm-hmm.
in the Nahe, in the Mittelrhein. How do you know that that tastes like that versus Riesling from Austria? And they would just, they're so open and so giving that they would just give all their information. And so I really feel fortunate that people like, just talked to me yesterday, Tom Kaufman back from Rancho Pinot Grill in Arizona,
mm-hmm.
to Paul Roberts at French Laundry, Bobby Stuckey at Frosca Food and Wine, Greg Tresner from the Phoenician, Chris Kuhn from Montage. When I was, and finishing off undergrad and going to graduate school, these people took me under their wing and throughout the way, just to really help me out. So it was just paying attention and writing a lot of notes. You remember those mead binders,
mm-hmm.
The little black and white ones?
Oh, yeah.
that you used to get in grade school.
Mm-hmm.
I have about 20 of those saved with notes from 2000. And on the front, what I have is it's a quick write-up going, okay, these are the wines that I've tasted in this journal. These are the wines of highlight, and then I have everything flagged.
Mm-hmm.
So if I ever wonder, like, man, I wonder what a vertical of Dalabal tastes like, Maya.
Yeah.
I know what folder to go to.
Now, how many wines do you suppose you taste a year?
That's a great
different
question.
Wines.
I would love to know.
Yeah, you haven't kept track.
I haven't kept track. More than my share, I would say. I mean, I can't really peg a number on that.
Got to be thousands, though.
I would say.
Yeah.
I would
yeah.
say. I think I would venture to bet a lot of sommeliers taste roughly around that.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Now, when you make a recommendation in the restaurant, are you looking to discern the customer's preference in terms of a wine style, or are you really trying to come up with the perfect match for the dishes that they're ordering?
A little bit of both, actually. A mm-hmm. little bit of seeing, you know, they can come in and go, I just want California Cabernet,
mm-hmm.
And I like drinking stuff that comes from Oakville, but I'm open now to some new exciting stuff from Napa and doesn't have to be Oakville. What do you have for me? Right there, I just kind of pick through and go, okay, so these are the styles that they like. Well, let's find them a home. Let's give them a happy medium so that they can, A, learn to respect my decision
mm-hmm.
and go, you know, that guy did me well.
Right.
You know, the next time I come in,
trust
I'm
going to
trust him.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, I also will slide from time to time, you know, if I have it available, which is usually 9 times out of 10, some product, you know, some wine that would go exceptionally well with that course. You know, and if I build a rapport with them throughout the dinner service, I'll just slide them something like, you know, try this out with that course.
Right.
I think
right.
this would be a home run.
Yeah. Now, do you ever steer people to just having different wines by the glass with each course?
We steer people to doing a pairings
mm-hmm.
and just being creative with it, you know.
Because I think that's a wonderful way for people to learn. I mean, if they sit down and enjoy one wine with their meal, well, that's great, and they learned about one wine. But if they try, you know, small glasses of 4 or 5 different things, that's a great education.
Absolutely, and one of the things too is we've noticed here a great increase with our clientele, our guests coming in and going, you know, why don't you just pair up the wines for us, and. You know, we'll ask questions such as, you know, do you have a preference or are you open to anything? And they can say, you know, I just want to drink California wines. Not a problem at all. Let's
mm-hmm.
get you some great California wines that would pair exceptionally well with this menu. Or if you're open to everything, perfect. Let's get you taken care of. You know, it's really kind of just anticipating the needs of the guests and at the same time knowing that they're coming in and saying, I want to have an incredible experience. Maybe I know how to go about it. Maybe I don't know how to go about it. But I want to get to that point. Can you show me how to do that? And it's just walking them through and, you know, going, hey, you know, these are great 2 half bottles that you're ordering. I'm going to slide you this right here because it might go with, it's going to go really well with this course. And here's something as well to finish off with.
Jesse, we're out of time, you know, and I've got to have you back sometime because there's so many other questions I would love to ask you, especially like what was it like to work with Thomas Keller?
That would be a nice conversation.
Among other things. Anyway,
yeah.
I know this is a busy time of year for you. I appreciate you taking the time to be on Whitley Online.
It was my pleasure, Robert.
And that's all we have time for this week. This is Robert Whitley for Whitley Online saying ciao.
And I mean, don't try to fool me. Be you me, either amused.